Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
I've long thought that the woman you're about to meet would be a classic walk-up start for a fascinating Australian story program on ABC TV. Well, tonight we've scooped Australian Story on Open House. Lots of big things have happened to her in her life. Mother of three kids, aged 15, 13 and 11. She's just announced she's pregnant again at age 43. For the last 15 years or so, this amazingly robust woman has suffered the debilitating scourge that is multiple sclerosis. On top of that, her job is sex therapist. All great material for an absorbing interview with Amelia Clark. Amelia, welcome to Open House.
Thank you, Lee.
It's great to have you with us. I should say congratulations on your pregnancy first.
Well, thank you for
Entirely planned.
Yes.
I can only begin to wonder, to start, the challenges living with multiple sclerosis and falling pregnant again. Three teenage kids as well.
Yes. Well, the teenage kids are terribly kind of helpful. So,
that's
you
good.
Know, they've had a year. The youngest one wasn't even born when I was diagnosed. So her whole life is knowing that she's got a mother who's very tired and needs to lie down quite a bit. So they're actually incredibly helpful. Actually, that makes it not too foul. I mean, I think I've got a bit used to the idea that I live a very curtailed life.
Fatigue is one of the most common
yes.
and significant things about MS, isn't it?
That's right. There aren't many people with MS who don't notice that they are affected quite considerably by fatigue and often say that they live half a life. And I certainly feel like I live half a life.
Mm. Can I ask you, is it getting worse?
Well, MS is so mysterious.
Yeah, it's like wrestling with smoke, isn't it?
It is. I think I feel that it goes up and down a little bit, and every time there's just a tiny, weeny step down. So it is probably very gradually for me getting worse, but certainly not in great steps. I've been very fortunate.
How and when did it start?
Well, that is also tricky, and often people report that they realise after they've been diagnosed they probably did have it for some time. So I was diagnosed with my second pregnancy where my leg went weak, and that was, 13, 14 years ago. But I can remember being at high school and having sensory patches where things didn't feel quite normal, and I thought everyone just had those.
I can only imagine you must be a tremendously robust and determined individual to keep the many and varied juggling balls and demands of that kind of life up in the air. Where do you think that determination comes from?
Well, one, I think I was just constitutionally lucky. So however I was knit together in the womb and however God decided which kind of characteristics I would largely be given as a gift in my brain, I think I was already, kind of a positive person and fairly robust already, but then actually when I was 10 years old my father died, and as well as being the very worst thing in my life, and I would still say that to this day,
yes.
It actually was incredibly helpful in which sounds like an awful thing to say,
yes,
but it was very helpful in that it made me realize that life was never just going to be an easy walk in the park. In fact, that wasn't even something that anyone could really expect. And it didn't give me much grief. In fact, it just meant that I thought, okay, well, I'll knuckle down and do what I can do when I can do it. And so it kind of really solidified that idea of basically being robust, as you put it.
Yeah. Is it too much to ask what happened to your dad?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, it's not too much to ask. I've had 33 years to try to process the whole thing.
Yes.
So my whole family was away on holidays. We lived in Sydney, but we were away in Port Macquarie, and we just had a nice day on the beach and we're going back to the car, and he had been having a bit of chest pain, but no doctors that he'd seen thought that there was anything really amiss. He was only 56 years old. Actually, he was a bit of an older dad. I mean, let's face it, he'd had me at 46, but no one thought there was anything amiss. But he got quite intense chest pain just when we were going back to the car, got out of the car, had a little walk and got in and went rigid. And my mother realised that he'd obviously had some sort of catastrophic event. Mm. And then it was very traumatic. We, had to find the hospital, drive to the hospital. And they very nicely, the doctors and everyone at the hospital were gorgeous in Port Macquarie. And, quite obviously they did try everything to resuscitate this father of young children and
yes.
And a young wife. And but he died. And actually, the very lovely Anglican minister, who we didn't know from a bar of soap, but we had been to church on the Sunday, was called to the hospital, came and saw us, took us home with him, actually, you know, prayed with us immediately, and then drove us all the way home that night to Sydney.
Wow.
I know. And we've never had any contact with him since, so he's just this kind of lone, lovely memory and figure in our life at you know, the very worst point for all three of us.
How gold is that? Christian church-going family?
Yes.
How did that faith inform or shape what happened to the family, particularly you, in the wake of that, at such a tender age?
Now that I sort of think of it as an adult, I think, you know, maybe we were a slightly serious family in lots of ways anyway. We all, at that point, and my brother was just a tad older than me, we all definitely had made some sort of commitment to being Christian, and my father was definitely a strong Christian, had been all his life. But we weren't like the Flanders family from The Simpsons. We were much more traditional, capital A, Anglicans.
Yes.
And I think, actually, one of the things is he was such a lovely, lovely father that I was also really given a gift there by God as well, because I'd had such a lovely experience of an earthly father that it wasn't hard for me to believe that actually my heavenly father was a very good, good entity, in fact, an even bigger, more wonderful entity than my earthly father, and that he hadn't taken away the person that I loved the most in the world out of any kind of, I don't know, nastiness or perversity or randomness, that there actually would be something about it that would make, at the very least, eternal sense, but possibly even earthly sense. And I think that's actually been true for me.
Ever ask God why? Me? Shake your fist at God?
I know, you see, I know people do it out there, and it's completely fine that people do feel that when bad things happen. But actually, there I feel like I was very fortunate as well, because I always felt that there was an overriding, eternal reason for everything, even the bad things. And so I never really got angry with him. That's... You know, I can remember actually asking, which I know people would find weird, but I have a good memory and maybe I'm a slightly weird human being. I can remember asking him just as I knew my dad was being, you know, they were trying to resuscitate him. I prayed, you know, please, please, like, bring him through this, but I know you can't just do what I'm asking you to do. You've got to do what you need to do. So even there,
As a 10-year-old.
I know. So that's a little bit extraordinary. I get that.
And you say that that is the thing that's made you, as it has other quite prominent people, actually, quite determined in your life, the death of a parent.
Well, it meant that I took life seriously, I think. Yes. So, you know, kind of... Not that you'd want it to happen to anyone.
No.
Yeah, I know. But I was going to say, I think it kind of snapped me too. You know, it's the ultimate kind of face slap.
You grew up
really
quick
to have something like that. Yeah, I realised that life was serious. Mm. You needed to take it seriously. You needed to realise that you couldn't expect unadulterated kind of happiness and things to go your way.
No.
Hmm.
Can we talk about sex now?
We sure can.
That's what they've all been waiting for.
Oh, sure.
It is such a taboo subject in so many ways, to deal with it honestly and openly, even with a bit of vulnerability. Have you found that in your sex therapist business?
Absolutely. I think it's even slightly extraordinary that I do it, because, you know, it's not like I went into it as a little bit of a hippie, groovy person who thought it was kind of cool. I thought sex is important. Sex isn't scary, sort of in a big, important way, but it's definitely hard for people to talk about. Mm. And because I had decided I was going to be a brave human being, mainly after my father dying, actually, I was terribly shy until then, but I sort of realised that actually we need people to be brave, so I'd sort of made that decision. I thought, actually, I think this is very important. I think people shy away from it. Or sometimes the people who don't shy away from it can do a lot of damage because they're just kind of a bit silly about it. So we need sensible, brave people who actually want to love people who are going through pain surrounding it, which is, of course, all too kind of common.
A common thing. Mm. I'm sure the world is a better place for people like you stepping up to the plate on it. Can I ask you this kind of overarching question? What do you think the key is to understanding men and women when it comes to sex?
Well, I was going to say this is very interesting. And, of course, nothing's changed since the beginning of time. So, you know, I think everyone always wants there to be some new kind of easy way to understand men and women. But either someone, and I don't know who it was, you know, I stole it from someone, and the someone I stole it from, the thing that I'm about to say, stole it from someone else. But there's a cute little saying that is that men have sex to feel good about themselves, but women have to feel good about themselves to have sex. So if you want a huge generalization and you need something easy to remember, that one's quite easy to remember. Men have sex to feel good about themselves. Women have to feel good about themselves to have sex. And I think we need to be generous to the other gender. That's part of it.
Yes. Mm. So, I mean, simple as it might be, if you step back from it and look at it at the perspective of the other person,
yeah.
I suppose, which is other person-centered and
yeah.
true love, it probably will fix a fair few problems.
A lot of problems, because I think there's just a lot of problems around sort of ignorance and the fact that Hollywood sex has probably won up to pretty recently as the way that we view sex. No one is really offended by the view of Hollywood sex with the whole falling in love. It's actually got a technical name. Everyone can Google it. I'll tell you the technical name for
it.
That whole
it.
Falling in love thing, which no one has a problem with and everyone's totally, totally in adoration of, is called limerence. And
limerence.
That whole limerence period, which never in any relationship lasts for more than about 3 years maximum, is the thing that everyone's in love with. And Hollywood dines out on that. You never see films about people where that 3 year period's gone, but they are still enjoying their marriage, though it requires work then and more understanding.
So it's the process of falling in love.
Yeah, is that fabulous?
Not lust.
Crazy. Well, yes, it's not even lust. I mean, certainly lust is easier during that 3 year limerence phase, but it's even that crazy. You know, we get crazy chemicals in our brain, which, you know, cause us not to eat and. Because we're just so we're infatuated. So
yeah,
the other word
right.
for it is infatuation.
Yeah. Mm. You mentioned Hollywood, and we have to be frank and say more and more online pornography.
Yes, absolutely.
It has a lot to answer for in terms of the expectations of men and women
totally.
With sex.
Both of them do. And I think everyone sort of thinks Hollywood's okay and hasn't seen the evils of the fact that Hollywood is only in love with that limerence period, and which is completely unrealistic and non-long-lasting. And then people are now, well, actually, we all need to talk about pornography now because it's so ubiquitous. And actually, you know, I even talk to parents a lot of the time. Most children have been exposed to it by, they've done studies around about the age of 8. So we can't bury our
wow.
heads in the sand. Yeah, yeah. And so that's the way that young people, as well as, you know, those of us who are older, are actually, because people go, well, people are actually having sex, so it must be real. But it's just as much of a lie as mainstream Hollywood.
What do you say to parents who find that scary thing out?
No, I know.
It's 8 that my child may start to encounter that.
Parents listening to this freaking out right
yeah.
now.
What do you say to them?
Well, one, don't freak out.
Yeah.
Take a deep breath. You don't need to sit your 8-year-olds down and have a huge expose of the porn industry and all of its ills, of which there are many. You just need to realise that it will be floating around, and even if you feel like you're wrapping your child in cotton wool, they still may very much, you know, find that they come across it. So bit by bit and in ways that you can do. So back to this kind of bravery idea. And you don't need to stop being you. You don't need to turn into me or turn into anyone else who's terribly, terribly brave about these things. You can remain yourself, but just get a little bit braver. But just bringing up little things. Actually, I often find there's so much on the radio, TV, everywhere, billboards, magazines. It's right in front of you. That you can sometimes just curiously say to your children, what do you think about that picture? Or, you know, how does that make you feel about being a woman? So we're not talking about looking at porn images, but start to talk about the way men and women treat one another and say, oh, sometimes there are worse images than that, like that really show people actually maybe, you know, having sex. You can just bring up little conversations. You don't need to sort out the universe when you have those little conversations.
For older people and for adults, The issue again, returning to Hollywood and pornography, of expectations, is that at the core of many of the people who see you as a sex therapist?
People are kind of perpetually disappointed, and you know, I know that you're a member of the media, so I don't want to trash the media right now.
Oh,
but the media has not been terribly has not been terribly helpful to us on this one.
I've noticed. Yes.
So because the media kind of runs on a good story, you know, a good story is not that limerence doesn't last, and a good story is not that pornography is just stupid. Mind you, that's kind of growing as a story. But
yes.
So this is being pumped into all of us, actually, not just our children. We can't just think it's them. It's being pumped into all of us, this unrealism. You know, and I hate mainstream Hollywood just as much, because people are leaving marriages or leaving relationships because, you know, they think, I must be out of love with this person because I'm not in sort of that limerent, infatuated feeling with them anymore. So there's a lot of disillusion and loss of expectation because people haven't been given just realistic information. It's not even like you are a weirdo and you're not thinking straight. It's just we haven't been given realistic information.
So in a way, pornography is as bad as Hollywood.
I think so. And vice versa. I personally really do think so.
In terms of expectations.
I think so, Which is kind of good news to everyone there, because I think sometimes men think, I can't live up to that Hollywood kind of handsome leading man kind of image. And women often feel the same way about pornography too. I can't live up to being those women in those films and photos and so on.
What's the advice you most commonly dispense to couples or individuals with difficulties, challenges with sex?
Yes. Well, I think actually you touched on it before when you're talking about being other sort of person-centred. I think it is learning, which we can, with information actually more than anything else, to actually understand, in particular, the opposite gender. So everyone within, you know, a gender is individual. So once again, you need to know the person that you're choosing to be with, that you are with. But it's that kind of empathy, that understanding that actually men are different, and it doesn't mean they're horrible. In fact, there are probably all sorts of reasons why men look at porn, which actually comes from a good God-created place. You know, really, men were created to think that actually Eve looked fabulous. You know, he looked at her and he thought she was awesome. So there's a lot in that kind of looking and liking that is actually pre-fall. So I think it's jumping into the other person's head a bit, even though we'll never understand. I will never understand, despite the fact that I do this for a living. I will never understand men completely. I really like them. And I think that's the thing to learn, is they're different, or women are different, but it doesn't mean they're wrong or they're evil or they're out to get us in some hideous way.
Does it help to believe or accept or understand that sex is a gift from God? An amusing one, but
well,
a good
I know,
one.
But it's like people don't understand that it's amusing, actually. I think actually both Hollywood and porn are kind of deeply serious. So
yes.
Whereas actually it is quite funny, and you really, a sense of humour is a great thing
yes.
to have on your side. But, you know, people take it way, way, way too seriously in a way. I think it is helpful. Sometimes that almost raises it too high in people's minds so that they get completely carried away. And I think actually God wanted us to be way more realistic than that about it. It is a good thing. But we aren't to get carried away like it's the ultimate thing or the only thing. And it has all these unrealistic tags around it. You know, he really is quite a real God, I think. And it's good, but it's not everything.
Can I finish by asking you this, with the challenges and the opportunities you've experienced in your life and the insights into, as we deal here on Open House, into life, faith and culture you have. You're an optimist or a pessimist?
Well, I like to call myself, I've done some thinking about this one, Lee, I like to call myself an optimistic pessimist. So ultimately, I'm very optimistic.
Okay.
You know, I really feel held by God. I do. I feel ultimately held by God, and death really does not terrify me at all, because I know he has it all in hand. He has it all in hand. But even though he has it in hand, it does not mean that we've been promised a pain-free life here. In fact, actually, we've been told to expect it. So I do expect it, which doesn't mean that the pain doesn't hurt. The pain still hurts, but it's not such a shock, maybe. So that's the pessimistic bit of me. But ultimately, you know, very optimistic, actually, that I am held and will be absolutely eternally happy And I do feel completely loved by God, actually. And now I'm lucky. I know there are people sitting listening to this who think, I wish I felt like that. And I understand that I actually think I was given a gift to feel more that way.
Mm. Sounds like a very grounded perspective to me. Amelia Clark, it's been a wonderful conversation, and hardly surprising it's been so wonderful. Thanks very much for joining us on Open House.
Thank you very much for inviting me in.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast, thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.